is the future, technology, theocracy, and the thousand-year Reich, which might sound like a crock of expletive deleted to some people. I do think, though, that in a strange sort of way, technology, religion, and totalitarianism are going to be fused in the world that's coming. Whenever you're talking about the future, whenever one is talking about the future, obviously to a certain extent, one is casting about. The future hasn't happened yet. So I want to underscore that what I'm doing this evening is engaging in informed conjecture. For that reason, rather than attempt to play Gene Dixon and give you specific predictions, you know, Princess Di will marry Newt Gingrich later on this year or something of that kind, I'm going to attempt to outline the basic features of the way in which I think the world is going to develop and why I think the world is going to develop in that fashion. I will make a few relatively specific predictions, but I want to stress that getting too specific in one's predictions, I think, is asking for trouble. For one thing, it's pretentious as hell, and I try to avoid pretense when I can. I can be pretty hard-nosed about my analysis of what is going on and what has gone on in the past, because the past and the present, at least to a certain extent, are knowable. The future, obviously, has not happened yet, and so to a certain extent, becoming too detailed, I think, is a form of dishonesty, and that's not something that I want to start the new year off by engaging in. I also am going to strive mightily, and this is going to be maybe the most difficult aspect of the talk this evening, I'm going to strive mightily to conclude things in time so that we have a sizable amount of time for questions from the audience, and what might be missing in terms of specifics in the lecture will hopefully be filled in by commentary and or constructive criticism, hopefully constructive criticism, or questions on your part. In part, at least, in hopes of finishing in time to have questions, one of the reasons why I'm not going to get into too much detail about what is going to be happening. I also want to emphasize that past the point, the things that I see as developing, well, I certainly think they're going to happen, but I would not want to be pinned down as to saying exactly when I think this is going to happen, or precisely when the world that I see coming is going to be in effect. As conjectural as the discussion is going to be this evening, I also want to emphasize that I believe very strongly that as a general consideration, the direction that I see things taking and the direction that I'm going to be outlining for you this evening is definitely where I think things are going. And I think there are already enough firm indications of the direction things are taking that we can, in a sense, extrapolate from the direction things are going in now to where things are going to be going at some point in the future. In a future broadcast on Roy's program, you will be hearing some programs in which I read the information that I'm going to be kicking off the lecture this evening by reading, by way of perhaps presenting a contemporary analytical framework in order to serve as a launching pad or a point of departure for the line of analysis that I'm going to be presenting this evening. I'd like to read a section of one and all of another op-ed column that appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle on successive days in the second week in January of this year. In past broadcasts, I've stated that something that leaves me feeling very ambivalent is the extent to which I'm now reading on the editorial pages and in the op-ed columns of major daily newspapers. I'm reading comments by editorial writers, by guest columnists that sound like they could have been taken straight off of One Step Beyond, either One Step Beyond of 10 years ago or One Step Beyond of 10 weeks ago. On the one hand, that is a positive experience because it is reinforcing of one's own political instincts and affirming of one's own political vision and line of analysis. So that is a positive, that engenders a positive reaction. On the other hand, what is going on and what is being presented in these columns and in this commentary is so absolutely, unequivocally awful that I find myself feeling bad about feeling good. And maybe that is about as good a place for analyzing what's going to be happening in the future as one could. It's not so much that you're going to be feeling bad about feeling good, but I think there are going to be massive forces conspiring, and I mean conspiring with a capital C. There's a C word, conspiracy. There will be very powerful forces. Oh, by the way, are we rolling here? Good. There will be very powerful forces that are going to be conspiring mightily in the future to make you feel good about feeling bad. Because I think that the direction that things are going to be taking is going to be extremely unpleasant for the vast majority of people. That majority of people will be capable of reversing the situation. Do we have a copy of the flyer for tonight's lecture handy? If we could perhaps circulate a couple of these around. The artwork, for those of you who have not seen it, there's a motto here that says, "Don't ever give up." And it shows a large bird, a heron or a crane or something like that, attempting to swallow a frog. That's what's here. And the frog is grabbing the bird around its neck and constricting its throat so it can't swallow it, even as it is in the beak of the bird. I guess you could say it was paying the bill under the circumstances. This, in a sense, is the underlying message. I'm sometimes accused, perhaps not unjustly so, of presenting things in such a way as I defeat people psychologically. I make them feel as though things are hopeless, and they then leave either a broadcast of mine and or a lecture feeling that there's absolutely nothing that they can do. It is a very common response on people's part to say, "Well, gee, Dave, you know, I believe the things you're saying, but I just feel so overwhelmed that I don't think there's anything that I can do." I think that things are indeed moving in a very, very bad direction. I think that there are two elements of hope, or perhaps one element of hope and one element of determination, which hopefully will propel you in the direction of hope. One of the things that I think is a cause for optimism, and I don't think there are many, but that is the tremendous expansion in the ability of an individual to assimilate and process and communicate information. The invention of relatively primitive technological devices such as the radio and the cassette recorder and the talk show and the telephone permit things like talk radio, which, even though it has been used as a vehicle for political reaction in recent years in this country, offers a tremendous opportunity for people to communicate with their fellow citizens. When you call up KABC or KFI or one of these other stations, yeah, granted, the host might be somebody that would have been rejected as a walk-on for the Flintstones. That does not necessarily mean, though, that with a little bit of forethought and with a little bit of determination, you can't use that program to communicate with other people. So I know on many of the talk shows in Northern California, the hosts are very quick with the finger on the phone button if you don't agree with them, and most of them fall to the right of Ivan the Terrible. But nonetheless, if you get a few people together and keep hammering away, it sounds very bad for a talk show host to cut off six people in a row. It makes him look like an executioner. That's bad, and he loses. And on the other hand, when you hear six or seven people on a talk show all saying the same thing, that's a very small number of people overall, and yet it sounds like a groundswell. It sounds like a popular movement. In a more sophisticated technological way, things like the computer, advents like the Internet, give people a tremendous ability to communicate with their fellow citizens, and I think to a large extent, the assimilation and dissemination of the proper information may very well determine the future of the human race. So I think it's incumbent on every one of us never to give up. I think it's incumbent on every one of us to grasp the neck of our would-be consumer. We live in a consumer society. Well, that heron is consuming that frog, and I think in a sense, that is the kind of consumer society that we're going to find ourselves living in. And I think it's incumbent on each of us to grab the throat of our would-be devourer and to use our ability to assimilate and communicate information to prevent getting swallowed, even though it might appear that we're just about to go down the throat of our tormentor. I also think it's important not to kid oneself about just how bad things are and about how bad things are going to be, because things are going to get really, really bad. If you think things are bad now, just bear in mind the old saying that there's nothing like stepping in a cow flop to make you realize how nice tripping over a stone could be and can be. And right now we're tripping over a stone. Well, just wait till you step in a cow flop. These are going to look like the good old days, as bad as they may seem now. That, I think, can be utilized in a strategic sense to motivate oneself to shoulder the task of being a good citizen, to shoulder the task of assimilating information and communicating it in order to educate one's fellow citizens to a sufficient extent to permit viable, broad-based political action, because all of our survival, I think, spiritually, I suspect, as well as physically, is going to depend on a sufficient number of people becoming sufficiently effective in the arena of political action. So don't ever kid yourself about what the consequences will be if you don't grab that bird's throat. You will get et, no question about it. You will be swallowed, and it will not be a whole lot of fun. Again, to repeat that pun that I was making, you will pay the bill, so to speak. Well, there were two columns that appeared in January of 1995, just a couple of weeks ago, actually a little over a week ago, which in many ways, I think, as I said earlier, will serve as a point of departure for tonight's discussion. On Thursday, January 12th of 1995, there was an op-ed column in the San Francisco Chronicle, a very conservative newspaper, by the way, 50% owned by the Hearst Organization. There was an op-ed column by Arthur Miller, the famous playwright and author of, among other plays, Death of a Salesman, that many people are familiar with. Arthur Miller began in a satirical vein, and he entitled this column, "The Best Congress Money Can Buy." What he begins by doing is suggesting that we simply remove the hypocrisy from our contemporary political system by having our congressional representatives employed directly by various corporations. In other words, a representative, rather than representing ostensibly the 12th congressional district, would simply represent General Motors or a drug company or something of that kind, and that this would actually eliminate hypocrisy, would stimulate interest in our political system, because now the veneer would be taken off and people would be able to appreciate the political process for what it really is. He also goes on to say that the same thing should happen with the Supreme Court. This way the auto industry justice could work out a quid pro quo with the agribusiness justice to throw out cases which might be harmful to the interests of that are backing each of the justices. Then, however, Arthur Miller switches to a much more incisive and serious vein, and I think he delivers a body blow which should not be misunderstood by people reading the column. I think he then goes on to highlight and underscore the nature of his satirical comments by making some comments that I not only agree with, but some comments that I think we all need to understand, and also, not incidentally, comments which agree completely with an analysis that I presented about 5 years previous to the time this column was written. In February of 1990, almost 5 years ago, I did an archive show called Uncle Sam and Il Duce, American Support for Mussolini and the Mythology of the Corporate State, in which I analyzed Mussolini's corporate state. I compared various features, economic and political features of Mussolini's corporate state, and in turn compared Mussolini's corporate state and the economy that was created by it with the economy under Ronald Reagan and George Bush. Then in January of 1995, Arthur Miller penned the following remarks in the San Francisco Chronicle almost 5 years after I did that archive show, which, by the way, is available from Archives on Audio and which has been played on Roy Tuckman's show. Arthur Miller, after speaking in a satirical vein, goes on to say, "Some will object that such a system of what might be called legalized corruption would leave out the public and its interests. But this is no longer a problem when you realize that there is no public, and therefore no public interest in the old sense. Possible objections. The abstract idea of justice would disappear under a system that takes only private economic interests into account. Secondly, the corporate state, which this resembles, was Mussolini's concept and resulted in the looting of the public by private interests empowered by the state. Objection to the objections. We already have a corporate state. All privatization would do would be to recognize it as a fact. Conclusion, we are in bad trouble. Amen. I agree with that analysis completely. The whole point, and this is not to blow my own horn, but the whole point of Uncle Sam and Il Duce was that we do indeed have a corporate state, that the political and economic realities that were refined, not invented or brought upon us, but that were refined and fitted, I guess you could say, to the contemporary world by Ronald Reagan, George Bush, and the powers behind them, are identical with the political and economic realities that underlay Mussolini's corporate state. And the corporate state is going to be one of the points of departure in terms of the direction of analysis this evening. Beyond that, the very next day, appropriately enough, Friday, January 13th of 1995, in the very same place, as a matter of fact, on the op-ed page of the San Francisco Chronicle, there was a column by Deborah Saunders of the San Francisco Chronicle, a very conservative political analyst. Usually she serves as a shill for the far right. Here, however, she makes some comments in which she extrapolates not only on the recent slap concerning the Los Angeles chapter of the Mensa newsletter, which came out with some articles advocating eugenics and euthanasia and the building of a master race, very much along the lines of what Hitler advocated in Germany. Then Deborah Saunders goes on to ruminate about American society and its values and comes up with some conclusions that are very similar to the line of speculation that I have been engaging in concerning the drift in the direction of euthanasia and the American euthanasia program or incipient euthanasia program and the history of eugenics, the international mental hygiene, and the international eugenics movements, which I discussed in my last lecture down here in November, and which figure very strongly in the background of such seemingly disparate phenomena as the best-selling book, The Bell Curve, a horrible piece of science, and one which is, I guess you could say, ringing true for a lot of people, despite the fact that it's readily verifiable BS. The eugenics, euthanasia question also looms very large in the background of such phenomena as Proposition 187, which had strong backing from the same sorts of eugenics advocates that had backed Adolf Hitler and that are pushing things in a similar direction in the United States. Deborah Saunders ruminated about the comments in the Mensa newsletter, and she entitled her column, Death Instead of Taxes. Of course, there's an old cliche that something is as sure as death and taxes. Here, however, she has corrupted that slightly and has entitled, as I said, her column, Death Instead of Taxes. If we were to take the word taxes in the context that Deborah Saunders is using it in this column, and or to perhaps dolly back, draw the camera back, and assign a larger framework of meaning to the word taxes, instead of referring to taxes in the most narrow literal sense, if we are perhaps to see the term taxes here as representing, quote, wasteful government spending, unquote, the sort of, quote, liberalism, note the quotes, that Newt Gingrich and company are inveighing against, and the sort of, quote, wasteful big government, unquote, that we are now told that Newt Gingrich and company are going to free us from, I think that what we are likely to be seeing in the future is a transition from what is essentially a relatively benign or even a benevolent social system, and granted, this society is rife with injustice, deep centuries-old injustice. But as I said earlier, there's nothing like stepping in a cow flop to make you realize how nice tripping over a stone can be. And when you hear Newt Gingrich or Oliver North or one of the Tyrannosaurus Rexes of the New Right now ascendant in the United States, referring to Bill Clinton as a, quote, leftist, unquote, or even a communist, unquote, when you hear the Democratic Party being described as a bunch of, quote, leftists, unquote, I think one could not fail to understand that to the people who are running things and the people who are likely to be structuring our lives in a fundamental way in the future, Bill Clinton is indeed a leftist, and the Democratic Party are indeed, quote, communists, because to a Nazi, a conservative would be seen as a communist. And Bill Clinton is basically a conservative. He's a conservative Southern Democrat. But compared to what's coming, he's going to look like Karl Marx himself, somebody for whom I do not hold a brief. But let's just say, as Ronald Reagan said at the beginning of his second term, you ain't seen nothing yet. He probably doesn't remember saying that right now. You know, gee, the old vaudeville line, you know, hey, have you heard Ronald Reagan has Alzheimer's? How can you tell? Ronnie is out of the picture, but though the song is over, the malady will linger on. And I think that what we are going to be seeing in the future, the world to come, will indeed be presenting us with death instead of taxes. In other words, basically, instead of this wasteful big government spending, you know, the welfare state, and all the sort of hoo-ha we're hearing from Gingrich and company, flat out, people are going to be eliminated. And those who aren't eliminated are going to be made to think that 2 + 2 = 5, one way or another. So death instead of taxes could have, in a sense, been the title of the lecture this evening, because that is how they're going to balance the budget, folks. They're not going to provide social services. They're going to get rid of people that quite either won't do without or clamor too large, too loudly for the social services which they either never received or used to receive but won't be receiving anymore. Nope, they're going to get death instead of taxes. Reading from the San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, January 13th of 1995. Quote, "We better face the fact that we have to kill people," Kern County Attorney Jason G. Brent told the Los Angeles Times. "There are not unlimited amounts of resources," unquote. Brent was defending a controversial article he had written for the monthly newsletter of the Los Angeles chapter of Mensa, the High IQ Society. In it, Brent wrote, quote, "Society must face the concept that we kill off the old, weak, the stupid, and the inefficient." Well, if they kill off the stupid and the inefficient, that's going to be the end of not only the Republican Party, but most of the Washington political establishment. So don't hold your breath about that happening. But I think that the comments here by Jason Brent should not be seen as the rantings and ravings of some pretentious super intellectual twit. Let me read more. Another Mensa contributor, John Evans, wrote that many homeless, quote, should be humanely done away with, like abandoned kittens, unquote. And again, quoting, "A piece of meat in the shape of a man but without a mind is not a human being, whether the body be deathly ill, damaged by accident, mentally blank because of brain deficiency," read in here the bell curve, read in here, quote, "niggers," unquote, or any of the, quote, special interests, unquote, that are perceived as ruining the United States. And as I've said in past lectures and broadcasts, forgive my use of strong language, but one should never mistake how the people in power in this country are thinking, and that's exactly how they are thinking. Continuing, "A piece of meat in the shape of a man, but without a mind, is not a human being. Whether the body be deathly ill, damaged by accident, mentally blank because of brain deficiency, or criminally insane," unquote. The reaction in and outside of Mensa has been one of shock and horror. Likening the infirm to blobs of meat is ominously reminiscent of the Nazi term useless eaters, unquote, which justified Nazi extermination of the sick. Want to know what the future of health care is going to be? It's going to be death instead of taxes. Continuing, some of you may be tempted to dismiss this story as an anomaly, the stuff of twit geniuses so intoxicated with their IQs that they've turned stupid. Yet, the belief that it is better for others to die than be a burden is becoming increasingly common, right down to the part about kittens. January's American Spectator magazine features a commentary which first appeared in the Amherst Bulletin, written by the Reverend Donna Schaefer of the United Church of Christ. Schaefer wrote of how her cat killed off her own litter, then noted, quote, "While not arguing for infanticide, I have to argue at least the plausibility of withdrawing maternal care." interrupting, I think that behind these remarks one can perhaps see the future of Newt Gingrich's Boys Town social agenda, where Newt Gingrich is talking about separating welfare mothers from their children and putting the children in institutions. The Nazi extermination programs under Tiergartenstrasse 4 involved the elaborate use of frontal organizations that were set up to care for these poor unfortunates who basically were enveloped in the Third Reich bureaucracy. The T4, Tiergartenstrasse 4 program, was named after Tiergartenstrasse 4, the address of the German ministry under which the Nazi euthanasia program was begun. That led directly to the Third Reich extermination programs. But people inquiring about their relatives, who by the time of the inquiry had already been dispatched, were simply shoved back and forth in the bureaucracy and told, go talk to so-and-so. And then in this manner, through deliberate bureaucratic obfuscation, the actual physical extermination of human beings was hidden. And one should never mistake the possible gravity of the thrust of comments like Newt Gingrich's, where saying, well, after two, or policies like that, well, after 2 years, if the mother doesn't have a job, we'll take away her children. What are they going to do with the kids next? Well, stick around. Quote, while not arguing for infanticide, I have to argue at least the plausibility of withdrawing maternal care. Pushing your children into a lake is hardly that. But Susan Smith, the South Carolina mom who killed her two sons by strapping them into her car and letting it roll into a lake, quote, was making an announcement. She couldn't care for her children. Instead of making their lives permanently miserable, she drowned them. There is a strange, cruel mercy in the act, unquote. This, by the way, is from a Unitarian minister. Continuing. Last month, an elderly Florida couple worth $10 million was found dead in their Eldorado, in their Cadillac Eldorado. Richard Brown, 79, had suffered from arthritis and asthma. Helen Brown, 76, had Alzheimer's disease. In a note sent to their friends before their suicide, the Browns explained that they were killing themselves in part because the cost of their health care would, quote, consume a substantial amount of their money, of our money, unquote, which they donated to the United Church of Christ Missions in order to, quote, help many young people throughout the world and who one day may be able to help many more, unquote. Rather than sadly renouncing the suicide as a tragic waste, their former pastor, Charles Huser, H-E-U-S-E-R, told the Associated Press that the Browns, quote, were taking the high road to death, unquote. Huser, by the way, said he was the guy who persuaded the Browns to leave their money to the church. I guess... what's that? Yeah. Oh, that is not United... Oh. Okay, then what is the United Church of Christ? Educate me about the Protestant denomination. Oh, I thought that was the Unitarian.
No.
Okay. I stand corrected. Totally different. Well, all righty. My agnosticism is showing its underpinnings here, I suppose. That's what I thought, but then again, I've thought the same thing about a number of institutions, which turned out to be not nearly as progressive as I had thought. Continuing. In November, Oregon voters approved Measure 16, a physician-assisted suicide initiative. Before the election, the opposition campaign asked likely voters this question. If you knew that as a result of the pressure to contain health care costs, a doctor might encourage a terminally ill patient to choose physician-assisted suicide over more expensive treatment, would you favor or oppose, unquote? 36% said they would favor. Blame it on the deficit, high taxes, or a rotting culture, or D, this says Dave Emery, all of the above. But a growing number of Americans view others as a liability they would just as soon terminate. Assisted suicide advocates seem to believe that this country is so moral that there is no reason to fear the misuse of assisted suicide. But when a minister defends maternal abandonment as being, quote, as regular people say, for the best, unquote, while another lauds a couple's suicide, where is compassion for the young or the aged? When more than a third of voters would rather save money than heal the sick, don't bet on America's reverence for life. I think there is much food for thought in that particular column, as there was in Arthur Miller's column the previous day. I would also note, perhaps it's irrelevant, but I think we should take note of this, because This lecture, again, was entitled The Future, Technology, Theocracy, and the Thousand-Year Reich. Note that the editorial comment being scored by Deborah Saunders in that column was being offered up by two people of the cloth, one male, one female. Two ministers were endorsing this merciful act, i.e. murder and suicide, which under traditional religious values, those are not values that are seen as being merciful and humanitarian. I think that the thrust of those two columns, on the one hand, the fact that we already have a corporate state, Mussolini, the world's first fascist, when queried by reporters as to what fascism meant, gave two one-word definitions. Mussolini said, and he was the world's first fascist who invented not only the political system but also the term to describe it. Mussolini said, fascism is reaction. And beyond that, he said, fascism is corporatism. Now, in the interest of time, I'm going to briefly sum up what it was that Mussolini was driving at, because the corporate state and corporatism, I think, in many ways, is going to be the raison d'etre, the reason why technology and theocracy are going to be used to establish the thousand-year Reich. That thousand-year Reich will be the corporate state, or will be created and sustained for and to a large extent by the corporate state. So I think it's worth understanding what the corporate state means. This will be, to a certain extent at least, a slight oversimplification. However, it's basically accurate. When you're at work and you send, your boss tells you to do something, you don't say, let's vote on it. You do it, basically. Now, if you have a good boss and you work for a good company, hopefully they consult with you before making important decisions. But basically, the way it works in the workplace is when your boss tells you to do something, you say how much, how high, and what color. You do it. You don't say, well, you know, I want to vote on it. Let's subject this to democratic process. Democracy has nothing to do with it. You do as you are told. Mussolini felt that a society should be set up along the lines of power administration that exists within a corporation. Basically, when the boss says do something, you do it. Period. You don't vote on it. You do as you are told. Beyond that, the economic rationalization, and it was exactly that underlying Mussolini's corporate state, was that if the corporations benefited, if a society was set up in such a way as to benefit the corporations, this would automatically benefit everybody in the society, because as the corporations benefited and prospered, the wealth would trickle down to all of those happy little creatures that were toiling so blissfully away in the workplace in order to make those corporations work. Basically, Mussolini was proposing supply-side economics, or what George Bush, in a rare moment of lucidity, termed during the 1980 campaign, voodoo economics. The basic features of Mussolini's corporate state were identical to the supply-side economics of Ronald Reagan and George Bush, and they did not work. As George Selby's, arguably America's foremost investigative journalist, said when describing what Mussolini's system actually produced, he said, quote, fascism is a, quote, spoil system, unquote. Basically, it benefited the rich. The rich got richer and everybody else suffered. In order to counteract the effects of this organized, institutionalized piracy on the rest of Italian society, Mussolini engaged in juggling the books, just like Ronald Reagan and George Bush counted the monies that were set aside for Social Security to help make the deficits they were running up appear much smaller than in fact they were. Mussolini borrowed a tremendous amount of capital from abroad, primarily from American lending institutions, in order to balance the books. That's what Reagan and Bush did. That's why, even though the U.S. was the world's biggest creditor nation from 1917 through 1980, Ronald Reagan had turned us into a debtor nation by 1983, into the world's biggest debtor nation by 1985. National debt was a little over $900 billion when Jimmy Carter left office in 1980. When Ronald Reagan left in 88, it was $2.6 trillion, or almost three times as high. George Bush, within 4 years, had put it up over $4 trillion. In 1993, the interest on the national debt was $212 billion, almost 25% of what the entire national debt was when Ronald Reagan took office. Just like Mussolini, Ronald Reagan and George Bush borrowed capital abroad to help keep the society going. Rather than even sinking that capital into the industrial base in order to expand it and create jobs, thereby stimulating spending, stimulating economic production, stimulating tax revenues and beginning to reduce the deficit. Mussolini sends the money into building up, he sends it basically into military-related heavy industry in order to build up a huge military, which then also needed some sort of justification for Mussolini invaded Ethiopia. He built up this huge military, hadn't done anything else in society, and he had to find some sort of justification for it, so in he went into Ethiopia. Ronald Reagan and George Bush, of course, did the same thing. This borrowed money was not used to expand American industry, but rather to build up a huge, huge military. Corporatism, the corporate state, was a failure in Mussolini's Italy. It was a failure in Ronald Reagan and George Bush's America. And it's going to be an even bigger failure in Newt Gingrich and Bob Dole's America, which is going to be so grim that Bob Dole is actually emerging as a moderating force within the Republican Party. Now, think about that. There's something that ought to scare the you-know-what out of you. As blues singer Taj Mahal said, man, if you ain't scared, you ain't right. And if Bob Dole is a moderating influence, boy, I'd hate to see somebody who is a political extremist. But stick around. You're going to be seeing that. The corporate state doesn't figure to be any more successful in the future than it has been in the past, and it has been an absolute unqualified disaster in the past. And corporatism is the literal battle cry that we are now hearing sounded throughout the political corridors in the United States and indeed all over the world. I think that the world to come, this technologically based fascist theocracy, which is what I think is going to evolve worldwide over the years and it may be centuries, that society is going to grow up in response to a fundamental conflict. And that is a fundamental conflict that I think is already evident. It is the conflict which is going to cause the corporate state, that corporate state which, as Arthur Miller has noted in this column, is already here, to basically give us, as Deborah Saunders has said, death instead of taxes. That is going to be the answer to health care. That is going to be the answer to cutting back on social services. That is going to be the answer to deficit reduction. A lot of deficits are going to be reduced. And very, very serious deficits they are. But the conflict that exists between, on the one hand, the needs of the corporate state, and on the other hand, the needs of A, the individual, and B, the ecosystem itself, at the risk of sounding a little bit corny. As the world's population has expanded, there has been an increasing pressure on the world's corporations, on the corporations which make up the corporate state, to meet the needs of the masses of humanity. They have not done a particularly good job. The number of have-nots in the world is increasing. Worldwide, in the United States and elsewhere, there is a pattern. And by the way, one of the things that I'm necessarily going to have to do in the talk tonight, this is an example, is to move quickly, much more quickly than I would like, over some very, very broad and important points of information. In discussing world macroeconomics, that is the subject for an entire lecture series or a program in graduate work. I'm going to have to cover it in the matter of a few minutes this evening. So if aspects of the discussion seem somewhat facile under the circumstances, again, the limitations of time, the enormity of the subject are the excuses for which I will offer up in asking your indulgence under the circumstances. But as the world population has increased, the pressures on the corporate state have increased as well. On the one hand, there is a growing number of people on the earth who want basically a decent life. They want to be able to earn enough money to support themselves and their families. They want the basic needs that are required to support human existence. Food, clothing, shelter, medical care, education. Basically, if they don't necessarily want what we think of in the United States as the American dream, they want something which at the very least is not the world's nightmare. The corporate state, on the other hand, is dedicated to making profits. That is the raison d'etre of a corporation. It is the raison d'etre of the corporate state, is to maximize profits for the corporation. Theoretically, and it is just that, a theory and not a reality, those profits would then trickle down. Well, that didn't happen in Mussolini's corporate state, didn't happen in Ronald Reagan and George Bush's corporate state, and I sure as hell wouldn't hold my breath and expect it to happen under the corporate state of Newt Gingrich or Bob Dole, and I certainly wouldn't sit around and hold my breath and expect it to happen under the corporate state of the future, which is very likely to be administered by Darth Vader or somebody very much like him. The corporation needs profits. The individual wants a decent environment. They want the aspects of the, quote, good life that I have already discussed, that necessarily will involve at least a reasonable compensation for their work, for the labor that they sell in the marketplace, in the marketplace of labor. Beyond that, in order to maintain a decent, a viable human existence, both for oneself and for one's family, the ecosystem itself has to have its integrity maintained. If you're dumping toxic chemicals into your water supply, if you're eroding the ozone layer, if you're melting the ice cap, if you're cutting down the rainforest, which represents literally the lungs of the earth, if you're pouring heavy metals into the ocean, if you're spraying pesticides all over your produce and putting them into your soil and spouting hydrocarbons and other residual from fossil fuels into the atmosphere, sooner or later what goes around comes around. You are literally setting the stage for the physical termination of life on this planet, human life possibly among the life forms that will become extinct. The corporation profits, for the corporation, I should say, and for the corporate state, profits are what matters. And the fact of the matter is that at least in the short run, in the view of the corporate state, profits will be maximized by minimizing or eliminating altogether environmental regulations, which cost money to implement. Now, over the long haul, poisoning the earth and poisoning one's workforce, not to mention oneself, is not profitable. It isn't even very bright. But the fact of the matter is, in the short run, it does make more sense to the profit-minded to dump the toxic waste into the nearest stream rather than process it sinking investment capital or sinking capital which one might put in one's own bank account into seeing to it that the toxic waste isn't dumped into the water supply. The corporation makes more profits in the short run by paying the workers as little as possible, by not providing health care for the workers. Now, again, in the law over the long haul, despoiling one's workforce, so to speak, is also detrimental to the long-term interests of the corporate state. It's one of the reasons why it doesn't work. But in the short run, the corporate state is going to see to it the amount of money, the amount of capital paid out in compensation for the labor that it requires, and the amount of capital allocated to clean up the environment are minimized. Because the less capital that is allocated to the cleaning up of the environment and the sustenance of the ecosystem, and the less capital that is laid out in order to compensate the workforce for the labor that they contribute, the greater will be the profits. The greater will be the bank accounts of the people who are running the corporate state. For that reason, we already have a fundamental, irrevocable conflict in this society between the needs of the individual and the needs of the planet itself, and the short-term perceived needs, please note the use of the term perceived, of the corporate state. I do not think that overall it would be impossible to set up a corporate structure that would be mutually adaptable to the needs of an individual and of the planet itself, but the fact of the matter is the corporate state and the way in which corporatism has evolved, they are not in harmony with the interests of the individual and the ecosystem, and that is why we are going to be getting debt instead of taxes in the world that is coming. This, in my opinion. Now, again, I don't know exactly when some of the things that I'm talking about are going to manifest themselves, what I'm going to be discussing for the rest of the evening, are the trends that I think things are going to be taking, the direction that I think things are going to be taking, and how the direction that things are moving in now is going to play itself out in the future. The conflict between the needs of the corporate state and the corporate state, by the way, one of the nice things about a small venue like this is that if there are people who are taping, and many are, just stick up your hand and I can pause for a minute while you turn over your tape.